feet again so that they can get out there and start supporting their families and empowering themselves, that their lives are not just based on what their past have been. So again, I would really like to thank you for taking the time out and coming to talk to us about this. And I look forward to seeing you again next month when we can talk about some of the trials and tribulations, because all that glitters is in gold. And so I'd like for us to focus a little more on how you prepare those students for actual real life, being out there in the trades, trying to make it, but running into a few obstacles. So again, thank you very much, Pat.
You're welcome. I will see you next month.
Marvelous.
Good.
Well, brothers and sisters, we are at that witching hour where it's time for us to say holla. Thank you very much for joining us for the labor segment of the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists.
To you, the 9-to-5er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Tune into cable every weekday at 7 p.m. for Hard Knock Radio. News and views from a hip-hop perspective with Davey D. Hard Knock Radio features in-depth interviews and profiles with community leaders, activists, hip-hop artists, and musicians, giving voice to community concerns and offering a unique forum to explore issues relevant to hip-hop community. That's every weekday at 7 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is looking for qualified candidates to fill two vacant board seats. The KBOO Board of Directors invites qualified KBOO members who are interested in becoming a board member to submit a candidate statement no longer than 500 words, which should include the applicant's experience, information about previous board or coalition experience, and why they want to serve on the KBOO Board of Directors. Please email your candidate statement to Timothy Welp at kboocommunity@gmail.com by March 13th, 2015. Candidates should also plan on being present at the March 23rd, 6 p.m. KBOO Board of Directors meeting to present a short statement about why they are interested in joining KBOO Board of Directors. Again, KBOO is looking for qualified candidates to serve on the Board of Directors. Application due March 13th and public presentations will be made March 23rd. More information can be found at kboo.fm/boardvacancies2015.
Sometimes you see that I'm mad. Don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good.
Good evening, greetings, and welcome to Prison Pipeline. I'm your host, Adam Carpinelli. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. This evening, we are here with Mr. Dan Shea with Veterans for Peace, Chapter 72. It's a Portland chapter. How you doing, Dan?
Pretty good. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, thanks for coming on out. I know you had a long day at work. So, and we're going to get into some pretty deep topics here. Dan, can you just briefly talk a little bit about your background, though, how you got into all the different activism that you do? Actually, you know, Dan does more than just, you know, peace and vets' rights and anti-militarization stuff. I mean, you do Latin solidarity, you do, you know, prison justice, anti-police brutality work and what have you. How did you get into all these things?
Well, you know, as a young man growing up, I came from the well-known Felony Flats, southeast area, very derogatory term. It's basically working-class families, you know, it was a rough neighborhood and stuff, but everybody had like four or five kids, and my dad was raising six kids in a two-bedroom house as a bartender, and basically, really, it's tips that we were surviving on. And I had never thought of it as anything different for any other kids growing up in the world. We didn't have much, but we didn't seem like we needed much, you know. I had some friends as I grow older. You know, I got in a little bit of trouble. I, you know, shoplifted, did a few things. I got away with it, but my brother didn't. Ooh. And my brother is just a year younger than me, and I think, too, I didn't know it at the time, but, you know, my father was born in Panama. We have Latin background. And my brother is darker skinned. It's strange when I look over the years, he got punished more. Mm-hmm. It seemed like he got picked up for things I skated on, and that was, my skin was, you know, white. And I didn't realize that for a long, long time. But I just, we saw that we were part of, if we were going to go in some direction, I skipped school, my high school years, in Marshall High School in the first couple of years there. And then my dad, fortunate enough to have enough money and tips that he was able to buy a house in Laurelhurst for $13,000.
Imagine that.
You know, can you? Yeah. And I started going to Washington High School. But high school meant nothing to me, you know. I mean, it just was boring, and I had difficulty in stuff. And later in my years, I found out I was dyslexic. So part of that was, I think, that. And when I, you know, when I got out of high school, I actually dropped out of high school. And I dropped out because I was going to class. I was, you know, just kind of skating through. And there was this teacher in this one class came back and gave me a paper with a big F on it. Mm-hmm. And she says, "You know what that's for?" And I says, "Well, probably because I didn't know what the answers were, you know." And she says, "No, it's because your paper is identical to the guy beside you here." Oh. And I says, "Well, ma'am, I'm sorry. I'll tell you one thing: I don't lie and I don't cheat." Mm-hmm. And she said, "Are you calling him a cheater?" I says, "Figure it out for yourself, you know." And then something out of nowhere, she says, "Well, why do you even want to be here?" And I had no knowledge, never thought of it before. I said, "I want to go to college." Mm-hmm. She says, "Well, we don't need your kind around here." Mm. So, what do you mean you know? She says, "You don't need a high school diploma. You can go get a GED." I called her something. I said, "F you," and walked out of the classroom. I called up a friend and said, "Hey, have you heard about this GED? Let's go sign up." Mm-hmm. We went out, took the test, and graduated before our class. So, I mean, I had this thing with authority, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, I just, the way I was being treated or the way people that were poor were being treated, you kind of rebel against that attitude that people have. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, you know, and I don't know how she was judging me, maybe my clothes or something. I had no idea why she even had that idea. I can't imagine what it's like for a person of color that faces teachers and people like that, you know? So I got in this real hard labor job, and I didn't see any future. Mm-hmm. And that's when the draft was going on, and I knew it was coming. I just kind of knew, and I just thought, I'm going to join up. And I was more joining up because I was thinking about, I had no future. And, mm-hmm. you know, live or die, I thought at least I would, if I made it, I could go to college maybe. And so that was one of the ideas, like the poor man's draft, you know.
Right, right.
But I joined the Marine Corps. Mm-hmm. My brother joined the Marine Corps right after me. We were both in boot camp together. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you were talking to me earlier about, you know, my experiences and going to the brig. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, what is that for anybody who might not be familiar with
that term? Well, the brig is basically a military prison, you know. Mm-hmm. So in Camp Pendleton, they had what they called a red line brig. And that was for pretty hard criminal people. If you couldn't walk off that line, you could be beaten down or, mm-hmm. you know, or even shot, supposedly. At least that's what they told you. Mm-hmm. The area that I was in was a little less because we were just going to be there temporarily. I had gone AWOL just before going to Vietnam. And more because it caught me and another guy from Portland. You know, we got drunk and we stayed out a longer, and you were AWL already. Mm-hmm. We didn't know if we were going to live or die, and we thought we'd go back and say hello to our families, and, you know, one last hug, one last kiss, you know, that kind of thing. And turned ourselves in, come back. And immediately after getting back, we were accosted by, well, we had two, what they call chasers that would take us. We were under guard, basically.
Oh, okay.
You know, that's what the chasers were. They would run us from the airport to the, what they call the captain's mess, which is basically a little mini court-martial. Mm-hmm. And a captain would take it. They didn't call it a court-martial, they called it a captain's mask. And you would go in. We had this one chaser who was a lance corporal, just treated us like we were the worst criminals in the world, you know. And this other lance corporal, he was telling us, hey, be cool. This guy killed a guy last week. Some guy took off running because he kept pushing him, and he got in a fight with him and stabbed him, and the guy died, you know. So, you know, we were pretty shook up about that. We didn't know what to do. But we got to the captain's mess, and this lance corporal went inside before us, and he ended up getting fired. This corporal got this guy off our back, mm-hmm. but the captain just took it out on us as though we had caused that whole thing, you know, and threw the book at us, 30 days in the brig. First day going into the brig, the first thing they do is they have you know, they put you through stress positions and make you stand there for a long time, scream and holler at you like you're some kind of piece of dirt, and then get you in. They call break, and mm-hmm. break meant you had to get down on the ground with your hands over your head. You didn't get down. Most of us didn't know what to do. So, I mean, they beat you to the ground, right?
Oh, wow.
So you get down on the ground, you learn right away that you know you have no control. They close those doors on you, and it scares the hell out of you. It takes a few days, and then it just felt like regular boot camp, and it wasn't so bad. Mm-hmm. About a week before we're supposed to get out of there, the chaplain comes and visits me and this guy and says, you know, we'll let you out a week early if you sign these papers for Vietnam. Well, we knew we were going anyhow, so
right.
Of course,
I mean, what was the difference, right?
So yeah. We were out a week early. So mm-hmm. that's one wow. time, you know?
Yeah. So this gets right into the whole theme of tonight's program, which is that... So we're just talking here about, you know, these are military prisons. These are right. not for, you know, prisoners of war on the enemy side. I mean, this is even for, you know, for the troops, for the people that, you know, end up either going AWOL and or kind of inadvertently considered AWOL right. kind of in your situation. So it gets really into this question of talking about, you know, there's this old term, right, military-industrial complex, and it's been pretty popular for a long time. More recently, people are talking about, you know, prison industrial complex.
You always use the two together.
Right. And so so that's kind of the thing there, though, is that we know there's deep connections, but they still, you know, right now it seems like as far as kind of popular rhetoric, they still get talked about a little bit separately. So mm-hmm. I think what we're trying to do is kind of make that connection. Here we are with kind of hyper capitalism in the 21st century. We know that there's these market forces pushing all these industrial complexes because it's probably more than just prison and military. It gets into other stuff that we probably won't talk about tonight. But what are those deep connections there? What are some of those threads there?
Well, I think you know, one of the things any prison first of all is gathering people up. People have jobs because of prisons, you mm-hmm, know. I mean,
right.
they put like these guards that guarded us. I mean, that was their profession within the military, you mm-hmm. know. Professional police or MPs and these guards. In the private industry, of course, you're looking at now private prisons in which it's looked at on Wall Street as a way to make money and profit.
Right.
But it's also connected, like the military is connected. If you look at the military-industrial complex, Nick Turse wrote a book called Complex, in which he starts looking at how the military is involved in, let's say, one state. You might have a senator who maybe he wants to be progressive, but the they got Boeing, and they've got somebody manufacturing weapons or ammunition or something like that. Right now, actually, a lot of the prison, if you talk about prisons in the United States, and the private prisons, they are responsible for the helmets, the clothes, ammunition
really?
Belts. Yeah. So you have a slave labor kind of program in which, of course, the prisoners don't get paid anything. But here you have the military-industrial complex. You got the prison-industrial complex supplying the military with the materials that they need as workers that are slaves. And it was interesting this morning as I was just listening to KBOO Old Mole Variety.
Yeah.
You know, I was listening to... I think Clayton Morgenridge, I think that is his name. He was talking about the Civil War. And he was saying, now this year, we're like 4 years in the 150th Civil War, the anniversary of the Civil War. He said April 14th was the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. And we think of the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, we start thinking about, the slavery and the abolition of slavery and all of the things that went into that. Well, after the slavery, slave wages. I mean, you overthrew the plantation idea. In came the prisons, and in came the Jim Crow. And with Jim Crow, they started gathering people and using them to be slave labor in construction, on plantations. They hired out people, but they'd arrest you on vagrancy or any minor crime at all, and you became a slave for life in these things. And that's the way people made millions of dollars in these projects.
Mm-hmm.
Well, right now you're talking about industries that are making billions of dollars,
Right. So you brought one really interesting point, which is all the industry that is inside prison that is used for military. Now, I think another connection worth kind of making there, though, is when we talk about, who are these people inside the prisons that are making these things, right?
Right.
And, I think we have a pretty good idea of what the nasty demographics are. But also, in context of people who have served, people who were vets, people who were, maybe they ended up on the streets for various reasons, mental health issues, which is, one of the higher, percentages of problems that people have that are inside who probably, need to be in other places. So where's that connection with?
Well, one of the things, and I told you I was in the brig twice, right? When I was stationed in the Philippines, this is after Vietnam, I was stationed in the Philippines, and I didn't know it, but I was starting to go through my own post-traumatic stress. I didn't realize what was going on. I had a friend of mine who was a real good friend who signed up to go back to Vietnam. Mm-hmm. I had myself because I was sick and tired of the sort of boot camp kind of stuff there in running around the jungle, guarding these ammo dumps in the middle of the jungle. But and it'd drive you crazy. But what happened was that he went back to Vietnam. We were told in a month that he had been killed, and somehow he had dove on a grenade and was killed. And he would be the type of person to do that. And I couldn't deal with stuff that was going on, and I just started acting out. Now that's my own post-traumatic stress. In that process, nobody was an understanding about what was going on. I refused to go on post one day, and just refusing under some sort of right that I knew I had, that I said I'd fall asleep on post, I would automatically 3 days in the brig. I refused. I fired my weapon off. They took me out there physically and put me out there. I fired my weapon off when that's a no-no unless there's real danger.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went again. I was sent for captain's mess. My sergeant, after that happened, felt that he knew that I had protested rightfully and actually put his stripes on the line, but they didn't, the captain didn't accept that. He wanted to make an example. So I am again put in the brig.
Wow.
And now that's post-traumatic stress. My acting out got me in a position. Now, just imagine that same kind of thing on the outside of the military.
Right.
And you're talking to your boss, and your boss comes down hard on you, and you fly off at that person. Maybe take a swing. Maybe hit somebody. Mm-hmm. You end up in jail. You're going to be arrested, and you're going to be thrown in jail. Well, people don't understand the triggers that hit somebody when they're going through these emotional things. And that goes with mental health. You know, we have how many cops have killed people that had mental health issues? You know?
Oh, God, more than we can count, that's for sure.
So, I mean, this is the same kind of thing. It's not that the people are a stigma that they have, that they're crazy. It's that there are triggers that hit them. And these ideas of being forced, I mean, you're told, you're trained to obey orders. Mm-hmm. And when you've been in a war and you have killed somebody or seen people killed and your friends have died and you finally came to the realization that war is insane, war is hell, and you're not going to participate in this anymore, and you realize it was never your idea, it's somebody telling you have to do it.
Mm-hmm, right.
You don't want to listen to anybody anymore. You have your guard up, and you're going to swing out when anybody telling mm-hmm. you what to do. Mm-hmm. So a lot of these guys ends up in prison. Now throughout Oregon and a number of places throughout the United States, they have what they call veterans courts. Mm-hmm. And these veterans courts will sit down and work with people with the judges, with the prosecutor, with the public defender, with the parole officer. They sit them all down together and work out a plan to how they can help this person. Mm-hmm. And they have separate kinds of prisons or entities within the prison where they'll house these veterans, or they'll put them on parole for a period of time, and they have to check in and then go through some sort of treatment program. Mm-hmm. So they're starting to recognize doing that. And then I heard in Snake River, they just opened up a new facility there.
Right.
And that
right.
is specifically for veterans, but not all veterans qualify for it. So those are some of the issues.
Okay, so for folks just tuning in, we're here, Prison Pipeline, KBO 90.7, and we're with Dan Shea with Veterans for Peace Chapter 72 talking about the intersections between the prison and military industrial complexes as they're intricate related. A lot of it's through kind of following the money trail, if you will, mm-hmm. But also a lot of it has to do with the people themselves that have served these kind of PTS related, maybe I'm using the word in quote crimes, mm-hmm. if you will, that come out of people's kind of different mental health issues or PTSD as a result of, you know, being, you know, under all this duress and all these different military experiences, and then getting out, and then all these different things that are happening, like, you know, everything from having trouble, I mean, just basic life troubles, money troubles, becoming maybe homeless, and maybe that's leading to getting locked up. So can you say more about that?
Yeah, I just kind of wanted to mention something, because mm-hmm. I, in doing some little research for your program, you know, I saw that, you know, private prisons of sort are sort of big business, right? Mm-hmm. We don't have private prisons in Oregon because we have a union, Ask Me, which works with guards and prison labor in a way to protect and fight against that. Mm-hmm. So, but you see unions disappearing across the country,
yeah,
you know?
Unfortunately.
So, but I thought it was interesting when I found out how, you know, that rich and powerful people are so invested in these private prisons. And here we have, you know, who's sort of the architect of Iraq and Afghanistan? Dick Cheney.
Right.
Well, Dick Cheney has invested millions in the private prison industry.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if I was an Iraq and Afghan vet, it'd be a hard time not me wanting to use some of my military skills.
Right.
So that's one thing. The other is I wanted to just say that, you know, for profit prisons, there are 8 statistics that show problems, you know. There's a 500% increase. The biggest private prison owners in America is the Correction Corporation of America, and has seen its profits increase by more than 500% in the past 20 years.
Wow.
That's moreover, the business growth shows no signs of stopping, you know?
Right.
We've got They said 10, 60 pound lighter. They says one way for profits prisoners is to minimize the cost by skipping on provisions. So now you have the quality of prisons is worse. The food, yeah, everything else.
Right.
And the people that you're hiring don't have the
terrible
skills, right? 100% of all military helmets, ID tags, bulletproof vests, canteens are created in federal prison systems through prison labor. Mm-hmm. And through these, prisoners are generously compensated only cents on the hour, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And you got 90% occupancy. The state signs agreements that private prisons to guarantee that they will fill a certain number of beds in the jails. Well, if it's profit, there's no incentive to reduce prison population. There's no incentive to put people back out. The incentive is to get more prisoners.
Right, right.
You know?
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, yeah, it's like these guys have made our lives essentially like a monopoly board at this point, right?
Yeah.
As far as people, you know, addressing this, you know, the kind of work that you do, that Vets for Peace does, what are some intersections there as we get near the end of the program, talking about kind of where is the movement going as far as, you know, anti-militarization work, anti-privatization of these things and what have you?
Well, I think the war on drugs is one of the big mm-hmm. things for me in you know, being a part of the Portland Central American Solidarity mm-hmm. Committee, looking at the idea that, you know, in the 1980s, the military was invested in training the death squads in El Salvador, Nicaragua, et cetera, mm-hmm. putting these people in positions of power. And that sort of thing is also the idea that, you know, I got involved as a veteran to oppose that, not only through a veteran, but as also a labor organizer mm-hmm. at the time, mm-hmm. and to oppose these maneuvers. Internationally, Veterans for Peace has voiced itself, created statements. We've had people that protested. You can't talk about these private prisons without talking about the militarization of the border,
right,
and the
right.
idea of immigrants being,
yeah.
I mean, some of the major private prisons are locking up undocumented immigrants, you know?
Right.
There's no incentive to stop this this idea of, or create an amnesty or whatever the project for people mm-hmm. to come here, because they will, you know, they're making profit on that stuff. And you think about that. The military, it's not just the militarization of the border and it's about the militarization of the police. So the war has come mm-hmm. home.
Right, right.
However you look at it, some of these people in the war are becoming cops. You know, they come back. They're not going to tell you if they have a problem because they want to get the job.
Mm-hmm.
They may blow up on somebody. And I mean, we don't know how many of these cops. Now, I don't know if anybody's tested any of these people for post-traumatic stress, for taking mm-hmm. steroids, mm-hmm. for anything, being out there with the public. But then we have, you know, since Ferguson, of course, mm-hmm. we've seen, of course, it's been going on a long time, but we see that the military is now, if they're pulling back from the war, the military industrial complex needs to sell these weapons, and they're handing them over to police departments all across the country.
Right.
And we just see here with the Portland Joint Task Force.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, all the new gear they get. That's the whole thing, right? They get all this new gear.
Yeah, and, you know, there's a lot of money involved in that, handing it down. So the police, you know, I mean, they may not even want that stuff, but they're saying, hey, we get this money, we get these things, and all of a sudden you have this, militarization, these robocops coming out. And what did the military do? You know, the military in Iraq and Afghanistan went from home to home, broke in. Well, what do these drug task force do? They break into homes. Oftentimes, they're not even the person. That's the guy next door or something, you know?
Right.
And you do this in front of the children. Well, this is military tactics. This is not police work.
Right.
And this is something that we have to all be concerned with.
Right. It's an interesting point, because, I mean, there's always kind of that American kind of exceptionalism or essentialism, where we talk about, oh, you know, like women and children and other countries, and, oh, they're living in these war-torn situations, and, you know, but I think it's really important that we start to frame it, you know, to look at, you know, we're experiencing that here in different ways.
That's right.
But we are experiencing it. And, you know, that the way that it affects people is different, but it's very similar system, right? I mean, the economics behind it and the political motives are very similar as well. So we're getting near the program, the end here. Can you just maybe, what are some links or some resources for our listeners to check out VFP and other works you're doing?
You can go to, Veterans for Peace is www.vfp72 and then write out chapter.org.
Mm-hmm.
That's
right.
Our local chapter.
Great.
But you can just spell out www.veteransforpeace.org, and that's our national.
Yeah.
And you'll see a number of projects. Other projects, I'm also involved with Agent Orange and with what they call the Vietnam Full Disclosure. Mm-hmm. Right now you have the DOD has some millions of dollars to whitewash the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a 13-year plan. And
right.
We put up a 13-year plan in telling the whole truth about the war.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's great.
Incredible material there. It doesn't take much to really research. I think that people should read The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander. Mm-hmm. It has a terrific amount of information. I find it incredible. Angela Davis has been out there speaking about this for mm-hmm. a long, long time.
Yeah.
And they both are looking at the abolition of prisons and looking for a more compassionate way to deal with people that have problems in society. And to do that, we need to look at poverty. We need to keep people from going into the military to begin with.
Right,
we need to
right.
break down the military-industrial complex. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to take all of us to do that. And we break that down. We need to create a democracy. We need to put humanity before profit. And, I mean, these are just these simple things
yeah.
People can get involved with. And I can find anything just by Googling it. If you want
right,
to find out
right.
about the private prisons, Google private prisons. You're going to get all this
yeah.
information. The ACLU has incredible number mm-hmm. Information on this stuff.
Great.
And so does Ask Me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So these are important things to do.
Great. Well, I hope we can continue this discussion again in the not-so-distant future. And thanks so much for being on. Also, for our listeners, don't forget that tomorrow night, every first Tuesday of the month, is a prisoner writing community event. It takes place from 7 to 9 p.m.